On this episode of Off Course Agility, my guest is Marcy Matties. My guest today on Off Course Agility is Marcy Matties. And I welcome you, Marcy.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
And my first question is going to be, since I met you at Champs, just very briefly, and I want to say you're in Texas, but I don't know. Where are you located?
I am just outside of Waco, Texas, a little suburb of Waco, and Waco is halfway between Dallas and Austin.
Okay. Yeah. Texas is a big state. I've been to a few places in your state, but I certainly don't have the greatest knowledge of your state. I've been to Santa Fe out toward the west, and I know I've been in San Antonio, and I think I've flown through Houston. So that's about the extent of my Texas knowledge.
Well, West Texas is a long way away, so I don't go out there very often.
Right. Okay. Well, the first thing I always ask my guests is, how did you discover agility? How did you get involved to begin with?
Well, I had a rescue dog named Toby. He was a mixed breed, sighthound, nose hound. He was brindle, so the place that I got him, they had him listed as a boxer mix, but I don't think he had any boxer in him other than he was brindle. He was really more of a hound. And he was about average size, 18, 19 inches and about 45 pounds, but he loved to jump and try to catch squirrels. And we had trees in the backyard, so we had a lot of squirrels. And he I can't even tell you how high he jumped times to get squirrels out of trees. But when I saw that, I was looking for something for him to do, and I guess I must have seen it. I really don't remember, but I must have seen it in the newspaper, something about, you know, signing up. They were offering agility classes. And so I thought, well, that sounds like fun. You know, he likes to jump, so we'll go do agility for fun. And as most people know, that get started, you start in it for fun, and then before long you're hooked and addicted, and before long you've spent all your money that you don't have doing agility. So that's how I got started.
Okay, and how long ago was that about?
About 2009, I think.
Okay.
8 or 9. I go by what their NADAC numbers were, and his NADAC number was a 2008. So it must have started classes in either at the beginning of 2008, because I think our first trial was the Thanksgiving weekend of 2008. So
okay.
It's been a while.
Yeah, okay. And now you... my podcast is mostly about NADAC, but
right.
Do you do other venues?
Not really. When I first started with Toby, there weren't near as many NADAC trials around as there are now. And so we've done several NADAC trials, and he was not a slow dog, but he wasn't a speedy dog. And we had, you know, some weekends between trials, and so I knew that they were having an AKC trial over in the town that's about 25 minutes away. So I entered him in that, thinking, oh, I can work on getting his speed up. But, and this is not a knock on AKC, but AKC is not a venue for young dogs that increases their speed, because, it was a lot of jump, turn, jump, turn, jump, turn.
Mm-hmm.
So we really didn't do it after that. I have done a little bit of ASCA because it's similar, and in fact when I first started it was right at the tail end of when NADAC and ASCA had dual joint trials in a little town outside of in Fort Worth, and so I did a couple of those that were like kind of both. Mm-hmm. And again, ASCA trials are, you know, courses are similar. So if I came to a time when there was a long break in between NADAC trials and I wanted something to do, I would go do an ASCA trial. I did this last Friday a one-day UKI trial. Because there's, for some reason this year, there's just this long break in between NADAC trials. So I did that. And the beginning levels of UKI were kind of fun. I don't know that I would go any further than that, but who knows? You never know. But right now, it's predominantly 99.9% NADAC.
Okay, very good. And now, you mentioned, I believe you said the first dog was Toby, so right. It sounded like you went to classes, so... Is there a club that you went, took your classes through, or did you just, you know?
Yes, it's called WAG, Waco Agility Group.
Okay.
And I first started, you know, taking Toby classes with them, and got in with they had some really good instructors at the time who they were good at what they did instructor-wise, but they were also good at encouraging you and sharing all the ins and outs of trials. And so... That's how I got started doing trials. And I'm about 2.5 hours, thereabouts, a little longer, from Calera, Oklahoma, which back then is where Sharon lived and had the NADAC headquarters. And so I would go up there for some trials. And she had them basically almost every weekend during the late fall and winter months. And I found out about that because of people in WAG.
Right. Okay. Oh, that's interesting. So you, when Sharon was in Oklahoma, you were able to take advantage and go up there some. Okay. All right. Yeah. Very, very good. And all right. So I'll ask this because I don't know you. Did you ever go into like the instructor route? Are you an instructor of agility or? Just took classes.
I did teach when I was a member of WAG. After a couple of years, I did start teaching classes, and I taught a variety of classes. You know, we introduced pre-agility. Originally, it was just beginners, and then, you know, sequencing classes. And we added pre-agility when I was teaching. So I did teach. I taught all levels of the classes for WAG for a while. So I did that for a number of years.
Okay.
But I'm retired from that.
Yeah, that's very good. Now, I know you're a NADAC judge, too. So when and why did you decide to become a judge?
You know, it's kind of one of those things that just kind of happens over time. It's not like, you know, I had a light bulb moment like, oh, I want to be a judge. But because of my early exposure in Calera and being around Becky and Marge and Sharon, I picked up a lot about what the sport was really about. And, you know, it was very, in Calera there was, you know, no run order, no anything. Just when your jump pipe was ready, you just got in line and went. And somebody always different stepped in to judge because there was always, you know, several judges there.
Right.
So I would watch them, and I thought, that looks like fun. And then I, you know, got to where when I was going to other trials, I tried to kind of shadow some of the judges and pick their brains. And, you know, there's a lot of things that aren't in the handbook. You know, you can't put everything in the handbook. So, you know, if you're going to judge, you got to know some understanding of how things are supposed to be called or what the ins and outs of some of the rules are that may not be spelled out in black and white. So I picked their brains about that, and I would shadow them and stand behind them and, you know, not interfering with their judging, but, you know, asking questions in between runs. And I just learned a lot from people that came to Waco to judge, and it just looked like fun.
Right.
And so then, again, because of my relationship with, I was really, had developed a good friendship with Becky and with Marge, and Becky in particular, I asked her, I said, so what does it take to be a judge? And then she would tell me what I needed to do and how to apply and this, that, and the other. And I went to Las Cruces to shadow judges at a fundraiser there, because that's what they said I needed to do. I needed to go help set courses and help do some judging on a, you know, trial basis before you can get on the list.
Right.
So I did that in Las Cruces. It was a very small trial. It was like about 9 dogs, and one of them was mine. and then I also drove to Tennessee for the same kind of thing. Chris was there doing a fundraiser, and so I went out there and did the same thing in Tennessee and got on the list as a SP2. and just kind of went from there.
Right. So hello, whenabouts was it that you became a judge?
What'd you say?
How many years ago was it that you became a judge?
Oh, got it.
It's okay.
5 or 6, I think.
Yeah, okay. 5 or 6 years you've been a judge.
When you first start, you know, you're not on the list yet, and then you get on the list, and then time goes by, and then you actually start judging. So probably at least 5 or 6 from beginning to now.
Right.
Like that. More. I'm not good at remembering dates.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I was just asking. So you definitely were judging, you know, before we've had the COVID thing, and now I know I've seen you on the list recently a few times for some trials. Because, yeah, I look at the trial calendar occasionally, even though it's in areas that I'm not going to probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in your travels being a judge, was there any particular places that really struck you that you enjoyed going to as a judge?
I've enjoyed every place that I've been to. For the most part, again, you know, I don't know if there's any rhyme or reason to it, but for the most part, I have done most of my judging in the East, Northeast, some in Alabama, some in Florida, quite a bit in Maryland, and Virginia, those areas. And I have a couple coming up. Well, I went earlier. Last year, I went to Reno, Nevada, and I have one in a couple of months or so in California. And, you know, I like every place I go because you get to see different people with different dogs that you don't normally see, except maybe a chance.
Right.
And I guess probably the one that stands out simply from the standpoint of they have so many trials available in the area, in the Maryland area. I mean, you could almost do an ADAC trial. If you wanted to drive a couple of hours or 3 hours, you could probably do an ADAC trial almost every weekend of the year. Not completely, but close.
Right.
And so since they do so many and they have so many choices, I find a lot of very experienced exhibitors and handlers and dogs. So that's fun to watch. Going to Nevada, it was kind of the same thing. It was a different group of very experienced people because they have a lot of trials out there. So I'm looking forward to going to Palomar and meeting some more people that I don't know that are from the West Coast and see how they are with their dogs.
Yeah. Okay. So you enjoy that. And I mean, I know from my point of view, like judging it, judges are, you know, they're a very important part because without a judge, you can't have a trial. But sometimes it's, you know, you're out there standing watching all those dogs and at a big trial, that's a long day. And so I give thanks to all the judges and all the people that want to be judges.
Well, I give thanks to the course builders and the helpers and the people that, you know, set bars and knew the time of inscribing because, again, you know, you can't do it all, and if they weren't there, there wouldn't be a trial either. So.
Right. And that's very – that's so true. I agree with you on that. Yep. And – I'll ask one more question, like in the judging area here. Like, so in all the years that you judged, do you have any like a super memorable, funny, or just really exciting memory from that? I'm sure you have lots, but do you have one that you can think of? Right?
No, I'm really bad at picking out a particular thing.
That's okay.
I wouldn't say probably the memorable thing because so many trials are similar. A lot of the memorable things that are things that happen when you're trying to travel to and from.
Right.
I would say my most memorable travel experience was coming back from Maryland and on a Sunday night, and I was supposed to fly into Dallas and then catch a puddle jumper from Dallas to Waco. which is standard practice. And as we were getting close to Dallas, they came on and said that because of the weather in Dallas, they were having to reroute our flight. And everybody was just like,
oh,
groan, groan, groan. And then she says, and we're going to be landing in Waco. And I was like, yes, I'm going straight up. So, you know, it's not often you get a direct flight into Waco from anywhere. And that was for sure a very pleasant surprise that they dug through and found my luggage. And I didn't have to go through Dallas. I was home 2 hours early.
So it worked out for you. Other people on the flight, maybe not, but for you, it was great.
Everybody else was very upset, but, you know, there's nothing you can do about it.
No, that's for sure. All right. So moving on from similar to judging a bit, but or part of it maybe, is I know in 2020, I actually ran, and my sister ran, a bunch of courses during because we weren't going to trials last year, in 2020 because of COVID. Right. We pretty much didn't do any trials, but our local school in 2020 was setting courses for VT runs. And I remember a number of them were courses that were designed by you. Question about course design is, like, how do you go about that? I mean, do you have any secrets as how you start designing a course?
Not really. I started designing courses really before I ever got on the judges list. It was just something that intrigued me. One of my favorite subjects in school was geometry. So, you know, looking at angles and things like that, and doing a variety of obstacles and how you can put them together. It was just something that appealed to me, and I had time to do, so I started designing really a long time ago. And, of course, first attempts were pretty ugly. In fact, I sometimes go back and look at some of my first courses and just shake my head and go, what was I thinking? But, you know, until you start doing it and then see them on the ground, it just takes time to realize, yeah, that works. No, that doesn't work. It's just something I did for a long time. And I had a lot of good input from other people that did design who helped me and helped me look at what I needed to be looking at. Because that's really what it is how to look at it from a dog's point of view. It's something I enjoy doing and I have time to do. And as far as how you go about it, I'm sure everybody's different. I usually have something in my brain, maybe a small segment from a course I've seen at a trial, or I've seen at an AKC trial if I've watched somebody else's videos, or, you know, just I pick out a little bit of a sequence. I go, oh, that looks like fun. And I'll kind of start with that and then expand outward from there. And I would say 90 to 95% of the time, by the time I finish the map, that particular sequence I started with isn't there anymore. but it was a starting point. And, you know, it's like anything else. The first step's the hardest. So once I get started on something, it's not that it's easy, but it just kind of seems to flow most of the time. And I generally will work on it and come up with something that I think, well, that looks pretty good, but then I'll put it aside and let it rest for a while. And then come back to it, you know, a week or a month later and look at it again and go, yeah, I still kind of like that, or, oh, no, I don't like that so much anymore. I don't know what I was thinking. And I might make changes to it. And I will frequently make, when I'm saving my maps, I'll say, you know, this is regular 1A, because then I'll make some changes and save it as regular 1B, and do different versions, and then come back and look at which version I really like the best. So it's fun, sometimes frustrating. I probably have the most difficulty getting motivated to design tunnels courses. Because there's just, you know, there's just only so much you can do with seven or eight tunnels. That's different, you know. After you, it's like Hooper's got that way. You know, you can only, there's only so many designs you can do with the configuration of hoops. So it gets difficult to be creative sometimes.
Right, I can understand that, especially for like a class like tunnelers, where you only have the tunnel as the obstacle. How many different ways can you lay it out, and how many you know, how many different paths through there? You know, I understand that completely. But tunnelers, of course, is a fun one to run all the time. But
it's fun to run, you know, and that you want to make it fun, you want to make it fast, you want to make it different if you can, but you're also constrained by, you know, you've got to make tunnel entries safe.
Right.
So sometimes you could do something creative, but it wouldn't be safe. So you got to back off of the creative to make sure that the dogs are find the entrance and get in it without having to run against the side of a tunnel too much.
Right. And so that was interesting how you approach it. Now, I'll say, though, I looked at the courses that are currently available. I didn't see your name on any of those, but I know over the last few years I've seen your name a lot on the small space courses, and I would think that's got to even be more of a challenge than like for designing a course at some place that you're going to go trial, you know, judge, and it's like 100 by 100 or 90 by 90 or something. Those, you know, 60 by 80 or 60 by 60. That must be a real challenge to try to put a course into that smallest space.
One of the reasons you saw my name so much, and there was a couple other people that did a lot of them too. When COVID hit, and NADAC was doing what they could, and they started offering, you know, way more courses that people could choose from on a regular basis so that people could still keep competing at home, they put an email out to judges and said, you know, hey, we need help designing courses, because you can only go back in the archives and use old courses, you know, so many times before you can't use them anymore. So they put out, you know, a plea for judges to help design courses, and a couple of us answered the call and did that. Small courses, you won't see my name on any 60 by 60s. That's
too small.
I have done several 60 by 80s, and yes, they are challenging. But it's something that, you know, because so many people didn't have access to bigger places to participate during COVID, they needed to offer some small course sets. So, yeah, it's a challenge.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. Now, I'll ask this too, just because it's kind of a curiosity question to me. When the VT courses are up, and one of them is perhaps your own, are you, as a judge, allowed to run your own course for that, for the VT program?
Oh, sure.
You are, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I guess it gives you, if after you put that course on paper and you actually have to go run it, it actually gives you some feedback back to yourself.
Yeah, well, a lot of times, I mean, I have not set the courses that I've designed. In fact, most of the time I haven't. I've run enough courses to know, you know, whether this is going to work or not. But still, you get to a trial sometimes, and what you thought was going to be a challenge turns out not to be. Or what you thought was going to be, you know, fairly straightforward and simple, a dog shows you that's not the case. So no matter how many times you design courses, you're always going to go to a trial, have people run that course, and be surprised by something. And it may be, I might use the same courses in Maryland and I turn around and use them again someplace on the other side of the country. And the things that pop up are not, that are eye-opening are not necessarily the same in both locations.
Right. Yeah, that must be something to see. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to ask one question. You may or may not have the answer to this, but I know I had seen Jimmy talking about changes in 2022. And my take and understanding is that come June, barrels will only be in the new grounders and the gamblers, and they won't be in any of the other courses. Is my understanding correct on that? Is that how you understand it?
That is correct.
Okay. So, like, occasionally I would have seen a barrel in, like, Weavers to make you do a 180 to come back through poles or something, or on touch and go, or somewhere, you know, or even regular occasionally, where you might have had a 180 around a barrel. We won't see that anymore in those courses.
Right.
Okay. All right. So, but you'll still see it in gamblers and the grounders.
In grounders. Because grounders is a combination of hoopers and barrelers. So you can't have a combination of something with barrelers if you don't have barrels.
Exactly. Yeah.
You'll need to find a barrel.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I've yet to maybe sometime this year I'll see grounders for the first time. I have yet to see it myself.
It's fun.
Yeah, it might be. My dog is just, you know, he's still a youngster kinda, and I never really did the barrelers, and plus I knew it was going away. I never did the barrels, the barreler courses, and the hoopers. But my sister, you know, she has a dog that's at the elite level, and she didn't make it to elite in those guys, but she had finished her superior in barrelers and in hoopers at the open level. So now she'll be trying the grounders at the elite level when she gets to see it, I guess. So yeah. We'll see how that goes.
It's great for fundamental groundwork. You know, if hoopers went away and there was never another hoop, I would still be using them all the time because it's the best way to teach handling and your dog learning and knowing what your handling cues mean without having to, you know, focus on their jumping style. They can just, you know, run and focus on what you're doing. So I think it's a great teaching tool.
Right.
For
okay.
All levels of dogs.
Yeah, yeah. I like that explanation, and I agree. Yeah. So now I'm gonna flip back just a little bit. So you had told me at the start here that your first dog was Toby, and he was like a boxer. He was a boxer, I think you said. Now what dogs?
He had him listed as a boxer. He was not a boxer.
He was okay. He was listed as boxer. That's okay.
The nose sight hound combination.
All right. But I know I've seen at least one or two of your VTs, and I saw you at Champs, but my memory is not always the best on things. You now run Border Collies, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so you're running Border Collies now. Yeah. And I'll just switch over to the Champs topic. So,
okay.
I know you were at Champs this year in 2021, I should say, because I saw you briefly. I had a brief conversation with you. And that's why you're on my podcast. So I thank you for that. But do you remember what was your first Champs?
Yes. That's where I do remember dates. My first Champs was in 2013 in Springfield, Illinois, and with Toby. And at the time, he was the only dog I had that was running. And then we went back to Springfield, Illinois in 2015, again running Toby. But at that time, I also had gotten Dublin, my first Border Collie, and he was a youngster and more in the, you know, pre-elite category. I don't really remember if they had pre-elite that year or not, but I think so because I don't think he was in the regular division. And so Toby and Dublin both ran in 2015 in Springfield. And then I went to Utah the next year.
So that's a true. So in 2016, it was out in Utah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So I've done every champ since 2016.
Okay. All right. So So you were at 2017, which was, Ohio, and then 2019 was That was Springfield, Ohio, right? Yeah. And then again in 2021. Yeah. Okay.
18 was flat.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that was it? No, wait a minute. I think Gillette got canceled because they'll be going to Gillette this year.
It was canceled in 2020.
Right.
But it was in Gillette in 2018.
Oh, 2018. Yes, you said you went to them all. Okay, gotcha. So you go,
yeah.
You go both. Yeah, okay, being in Texas, it's not like it's really the center of the world, but you're able to go both. It must still be a haul to get to Gillette from Texas, I would think.
Chance is never a short trip for me.
Right.
It's always a from where I'm located. You know, it's going to be 16, 18, 19 hours one way or the other, whether they have it in Gillette or whether they have it in Ohio. It's something I can do in 2 days. So I'm fortunate in that regard that I can pretty much go every year. Not as fortunate that I have to drive a long way, but
right.
My drive parameters have expanded over the years. I used to think that 6 hours was the most I could drive, and I found out that's not true. I can drive a whole lot longer than that.
Yeah, it depends on, you know, how you feel about things and how you like to break it up, you know. you just
right.
take longer to get places sometimes. Yes. Well, I'm going to ask this because I don't know the answer to this at all, but I'm always curious about it. Are you an RV person, or do you travel using hotels or motels or B&Bs or whatever?
I'm a drive it and stay in a motel or hotel. Occasionally, like last year, I stayed with two friends at an Airbnb. So it's something I haven't done a lot of, but I've started looking at that option more than I ever did before, It's a good option if you've got people to, you know, share the cost with. So I like that part. But I would love to have an RV. If I ever win the lottery, then I might have an RV and could afford to put gas in it and
right.
drive it. But it right now I spend my money on trials and motel rooms because RV is really not a cost saver. In the long run.
No, it depends. It's convenient. Like, it's convenient when you're at chance. And mind you, I'm not I have a small pop-up camper, so that's, I mean, it allows me to say I'm kind of an RVer, but I'm, you know, my recreational vehicle is extremely small. But I am thinking about things. But I understand your thought there. It's like, it's not necessarily... First, you have the cost of buying the thing, and then you have to pay. Generally, wherever you go camp,
yep.
there's a little cost there, and you are most correct that RVs make you suck more gas down the engine of either the tow vehicle or the actual RV if it's like a mobile
right.
home or whatever.
Yep.
So you know your costs probably go up when it comes to gas and stuff. And, but understood. Now, I was just asking because I didn't know. Obviously, you've gone to Champs a lot, so I was curious how you did that and you stay at, you know, you stay at a hotel or a motel or whatever, and occasionally B&B.
Okay.
Yeah. And what you say about, you know, cost, I mean, that comes into everybody who does agility. You know, how much time do you dedicate it to it? And how much, funds do you allocate to going
right.
to trials and all that?
Right.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, that all comes into it. All right. Well, I think I've gone through a lot of my topics. Is there any other agility? You know, let me ask you one more question, though, because I sometimes ask, do you do any other activities with your dogs? Or are you pretty much just focused on agility with them?
Well, actually, in the last couple of years, I have expanded some. Not that I do a lot of anything else, but some. I like do dock diving.
Oh, okay.
And, Dublin likes to swim around. So he'll jump off the dock, and then he'll swim around and around and around and around before he comes back. Odie loves dock diving. He just can't wait to grab that little frisbee and bring it back to me and do it again. So I've gotten to where I don't really want to spend my money on Dublin just swimming lessons. So I mostly take Odie to do dock diving. But Dublin, I discovered last year or a year and a half ago, that he loves to hunt rats.
Oh.
I've been doing that with him when I can, and Odie doesn't like it at all. So it really kind of worked out well in that I can, you know, take Odie out of town and spend just time with him doing dock diving, and then I can take Dublin out of town and just spend time with him doing barn hunt. It's also easier on the pocketbook that way than doing both of them.
Right. Right.
So those are the two, other than, you know, both of those things have to fit into an agility schedule. And so that's why we don't do very many of barn hunt or dock diving, simply because a lot of the opportunities to do those activities conflict with either with me judging or with me already in an agility trial that we're going to, because agility comes first.
Right.
And so when those others are available and close by and they fit my schedule, then I'll do those. And the dogs love them, but it's not like we're not competing to get anywhere other than just have fun.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And just one more thought, because you're in Texas. Texas has everything residential wise. Are you like on a ranch, or are you in a condo? I'm just curious.
No, we've lived in this house for nearly 40 years. We're in a neighborhood, a nice quiet neighborhood most of the time. When we first moved here.
Right. So there's no rats to hunt. I guess that's where I was getting with that.
Well, it actually, the area, the place where I train is at a friend's house. She's got some acreage. She is on a rural road and has quite a bit of property, and she wasn't using a lot of it. She said, sure, come on out. You can put your equipment here. And she's the one who has built a barn and teaches barn hunt. So it's really convenient. It's like 6 minutes from my house.
Oh, that's great.
So I 6 minutes and train Odie with agility, and I go 6 minutes to the same place and take Devlin to practice barn hunt. Devlin doesn't train anymore for agility. He's not interested in training. He loves to go to trials and visit people, and he likes to participate at trials. He has no interest in training, so I'm like, I won't even take him out there.
Right.
He likes to train.
Yeah.
He likes to hunt the rats, so that's what he gets to do.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, you know, dogs have their preferences, too.
Yep, they do.
All right, now I think I might be out of questions. So, do you have anything else you want to share about dogs, judging, NADAC, anything?
I don't think so. I just, you know, I appreciate all of the people that Toby has brought into my life. From getting into agility, and I've been around enough other venues to know that I do the venue that's best for me, and it brings me the most satisfaction and the most good friends. So I'm thankful for that. Very blessed.
Right. Yeah. I think that's one of the things that everybody enjoys in agility. You know, it's great to have, you know, running with your dog and that team feeling, but it's also the people that you meet that just adds to it. I mean, that's the way I feel too. It brings more fullness and roundness to when you go to agility trials, to see the people that you only really see there a lot of times.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I thank you for being my guest. I know I had asked you way back at October, I think it was, in Springfield at the Champs. I'd approached you and said, would you be willing to be a guest? And then I know I'd reached out in the fall last year, and then I kind of dropped the ball, as my listeners may know, because I've kind of not had guests for the last few months. So I'm trying to get get cranking again. So you will be my February guest. I'm going to get this this episode all ready and get it out there. So most likely we'll hit the internet or however you want to describe it in the next few days here in February. And I do thank you very much, Marcy, for being on the podcast here with me.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. All right. And I wish you a good night. And I'm going to end this and say thank you once again.
All right. Thank you.
Just a comment or two to wrap up this episode. I thank Marcy Matties for being my guest. I will be looking to find a guest for March. Hopefully I can get my March episode out a bit earlier than at the very end of the month, like I did in January. I had my episode released the very last day of January, and now this episode with Marcy is going to be releasing the last Friday of the short month of February. I hope you enjoyed the guest with Marcy, and I look forward to finding someone for March. And so there's not much else I have for this. I did see that on the NADAC website, the top 10 lists have become final now. They were preliminary when I discussed them back in January, but they are final now. So it is official that my sister's dog, Belle, is the number one beagle in the regular class. And that's the only beagle that's listed in any of the breed. She's the only elite dog that was able to get 30 Qs in a class. And it happened to be, I think she had 55 points in elite. So she was the number one beagle. And I don't know if I mentioned that when I talked about that, the top 10 list. You have to be at the elite level. I know I said that, but you also have a minimum of 30 points. So you need 3 Qs in any class to actually make the list under the breeds. And then, of course, you might need way more if you're in a popular breed category like Border Collie or something. But anyway, it's official. Belle's the number one beagle for 2021 in elite regular. So we're all happy about that. At least she got on the list. And if you're going to a trial or you're doing a videotaped run, as always, I wish you happy trialing.